For all you elk hunters out there, chasing turkeys is basically the same thing. I know the reaction you just gave me, but don't knock it till you try it, and don't try it without OnX. The Hunt app will not only help you find new areas on public ground, but I use it to find out landowner info to get permission on private ground that I see birds on as well. OnX Hunt has a special offer for you. Use code CAL to receive 20% off your membership at onxmaps.com/hunt and find more birds this spring. Hey, I just sat down with the owners and operators of Maui Nui Venison. They're on a mission to balance axis deer populations on Maui while giving back to the community and run a totally sustainable operation. For folks like me who want to get your own meat but aren't always successful, you can become a snack subscriber, get some axis deer sticks sent right to your door. Visit MauiNuiVenison.com. That's MauiNui. Venison.com and use promo code CAL for 20% off your first order.
I'm sure a lot of you guys remember the old ceremonial hunting tradition of eating the heart out of the first animal you kill. Meat from those organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. You can get those same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And remember, use code MeatEater for 10% off your purchase.
From MeatEater's World News Headquarters in Bozeman, Montana, this is Cal's Week in Review, presented by Steel. Steel products are available only at authorized dealers. For more, go to steeldealers.com. Now, here's your host, Ryan Cal Callahan.
Hey, welcome to a very special episode of Cal's Week in Review. I had a chance to sit down this week with Arkansas Representative Bruce Westerman to talk about an interesting new bill that would be a game changer for habitat conservation. If the name Westerman sounds familiar, there's a reason. Representative Westerman is the chairman of the Natural Resources Committee for the U.S. House of Representatives. If you care about national hunting and fishing policy, this is a group of lawmakers you should be familiar with. The Natural Resources Committee handles many of the bills that deal with outdoor recreation, habitat conservation, and many of the other things that affect the critters we love to hunt and the places they live. As the chairman of the committee, Representative Westerman controls when they meet, how often they meet, and the bills they consider. One of his priorities this year is a new bill dubbed America's Wildlife Habitat Conservation Act. I'll let Representative Westerman explain the details, but here's the bottom line. This bill would authorize $300 million every year to state governments to allow them to better enact their wildlife action plans. These plans are targeted at species under threat of being listed as endangered, but the habitat work that would be accomplished would benefit all wildlife. So, without further ado, here's my conversation with Representative Bruce Westerman. All right. Well, Cal's Week in Review. We are joined today by Bruce Westerman, who represents Arkansas's 4th Congressional District in the United States House of Representatives, where he serves on the Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure and as chairman of the Committee on Natural Resources. Because we value your time, we're just going to get right into it. And we like to help break down where we can how government works for our listening audience here. So we'd like to just ease in with, everybody's probably heard the phrase, and now the bill's in committee. What the heck does that mean?
Well, it means the bill's been filed and it's first step that it's got to get through is to get through committee. And I've just filed a bill called the American Wildlife Habitat Conservation Act that will be assigned to the Natural Resources Committee. So as chairman of that committee, I can almost guarantee you it's going to get a hearing on the bill and we'll probably mark it up and pass it. But that's just the first step in making a bill a law. You know, if you watch Schoolhouse Rock when you were a kid, I'm just a bill on Capitol Hill. Well, bill has to go through committee. Then he needs to go through the House, needs to go through the Senate. And then you may even have a conference where you work out the differences between the House and the Senate. And eventually it gets on the president's desk. Now, that's the simple way that it happens. Bills can also latch on and ride on other bills, like the farm bill or some kind of an appropriations bill. There's a lot of ways to get things signed into law, but the purest, according to the rules of the House and the Senate, way to do it is to run it through committee, have regular order on it, debate it on the floor, pass it out of both chambers, and then conference together and get it on the president's desk.
And what is like the most common thing that happens when a bill's in committee? Are you actively debating the merits of the bill, or what happens there?
Now, the first thing we'll do, Ryan, is we'll have a hearing, which means we will bring subject experts in related to the content of the bill. And these may be people from the administration. It may be people from the private sector. It may be somebody from academia. As the committee has the authority to call in and invite whoever they want to testify on the bill. So we will have a hearing and we'll talk about the merits of the bill, see if there's any problems with the bill, let members ask questions. And then we take all of that into account. And the next step is we would have a markup on the bill, which means we would actually have the bill in committee. We would offer amendments for it, debate those amendments, vote on amendments. We would end up with the final amended bill in committee, and then we would vote to pass that bill out of committee, at which time it goes on the House calendar and it's ready to go out on the floor.
Okay, so you are the chair of the House Natural Resources Committee. So being as it's natural resources, I would assume you have like a hunting and angling background.
Yeah, I've got a lot of background in hunting and angling. When I was growing up, that's what we did for fun, and it's what I still do for fun today. So growing up in Arkansas, the natural state, I had ample opportunity to hunt a little bit of everything. Mainly as a kid, I would hunt squirrels and rabbits and quail and turkey and deer, a little bit of duck hunting. Of course, Arkansas has got some great duck hunting, not necessarily where I live, but in the southeast part of the state, and the district that I represent has probably the best duck hunting in the world. I've got that going, and then we've got all kinds of lakes and streams and reservoirs. But I grew up fishing in farm ponds, just any place I could get a hook in the water. That's what I did when I was a kid.
And then went on to, well, I guess because hound hunting is always a hot topic. And since you've already opened up your hand and said that you know Clay Newcomb, if you had to introduce somebody to hound hunting for the first time, what would be your sales pitch?
I would probably just take them squirrel hunting with a good squirrel dog. It's a great way to spend an afternoon. It's relaxing. There's a lot of movement. You can talk. You're waiting for the dogs to trail and tree, and then you rush up to the tree and spot the squirrel and shoot the squirrel out. And it's a great opportunity to get to spend some time in the woods and fellowship with other people and really have a great time. Also, we hunted deer with hounds when I was growing up and still do a little bit today. Some people may say there's not any sport in that, and I challenge them to try to shoot a deer running across a clear cut with a pack of hounds behind it. It's you got to be a pretty good shot to make that happen. But also, coon hunting is something I enjoyed doing growing up, and still every once in a while I'll get a chance to do that. I've got a friend that's got some coon hounds. When I was a kid, we would even trap as well. The hides had a lot more value than they're worth today, but also it helps out in predator control to help with your other wildlife, especially turkeys and things that coons and possums and other animals, coyotes that you trap, will be pretty rough on your rabbit and turkey populations if you don't keep them under control.
That's fantastic. And then went to forestry school.
Yeah, well, I started off, I studied engineering in undergraduate school at the University of Arkansas. And then after I'd been out of school for a while, I went to Yale University and got a graduate degree in forestry. So I'm kind of an oddball to be serving in Congress. I'm the only licensed professional engineer, and I'm the only forester in the House. The only licensed forester in Congress. I think Senator Risch studied forestry in undergraduate, but because of that, I get a lot of policy coming my way that deals with forestry and wildlife habitat. And the committee, if you look at the subcommittees of the full House Natural Resources Committee, we've got a subcommittee on water, wildlife, and fisheries, which U.S. Fish and Wildlife falls under that. We've got a subcommittee on federal land, so all the Forest Service, BLM, National Park Service, all the federal land agencies fall under the jurisdiction of our committee. And when you talk about wildlife and habitat, it all comes back to how you manage that habitat and take care of it. So I've got a real passion for us to utilize the habitat that we've got and the vast land that we've the public lands we've got in America could provide so much more wildlife habitat than what they're doing if we would just put the effort forward to manage those lands.
So is that background where America's Wildlife Habitat Conservation Act comes from? What was the impetus for getting this started?
Well, we're not getting the job done on the federal lands with our federal land management agencies for a myriad of reasons. For one thing, they just simply can't manage the land like they need to. But if you look at most states across the country, they have a state wildlife action plan, and they do a great job of implementing these action plans, but they're basically only doing it on state land and on some private land. So what the American Wildlife Habitat Conservation Act does is it will empower state agencies. Here in Arkansas, it'd be the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission and the Arkansas Forestry Commission to go in and actually do management work on the federal lands. You know, we've got about 3 million acres of federal land in Arkansas, and if you just managed a third of that the way it needs to be managed for wildlife, it would be huge. There would be people coming from all over to hunt turkeys and deer and quail. There's no reason we can't have natural populations of quail again, but we have to get out and manage this land. But, you know, the vast amount of land in our state is held by private landowners. So the American Wildlife Habitat Conservation Act would also allow these state agencies to go in and do management on private land. And you're going all the way back to Teddy Roosevelt when all these federal lands were being established. He recognized how important it was that we manage also on private land. And you've got a lot of what are called non-industrial private forest owners that may have anywhere from 20 acres to even 500 or 1,000 acres, anywhere in between that, that what they really want that land for is for wildlife habitat, but they don't have the resources or all the expertise to go in and manage it. So this program would allow the state agencies to partner with landowners to be able to manage their land as well. And it's got a provision in it, say if the state agencies manage you on federal land, and what we see across the country is our federal lands are way overstocked with timber, too many trees per acre. So we need to basically thin these forests and then do controlled burns, and it will work magic on wildlife habitat when we do that. So if the state agency does that, say on the Ouachita National Forest here where I live, then the timber that they thin out, they'll be able to sell that timber and keep the proceeds to go do more management work on additional land. So it will only take some seed money from the federal government to get these agencies up to speed and get things moving. And when you look at private land, say a landowner had 80 acres and he wanted better wildlife habitat on it, he could call his state agency and say, look, I've got this land. I don't know how to manage it, but I heard you've got a program where you can come in and manage it. And the state agency would do the same thing. They would look at it and say, you know, the prescription you need is to thin your timber, to introduce some control burns, maybe put some food plots in. And with the private individual, when they sold the timber, they would just keep the proceeds that would cover the cost to do the work, and then the landowner would get to keep the remaining proceeds. Or if there wasn't enough timber on there to pay for the cost of the land, then the landowner could pitch in to make up the difference to get the management work done. And the thing about this is once you get this going, you can come back every 10 years or so and harvest more timber and do more management. So it would be perpetual in a funding mechanism to create better wildlife habitat. And also the states could just use the money to go out and do management on land that's not necessarily going to produce a any kind of revenue to keep funding the program. We've got a lot of green tree reservoirs here in Arkansas, and actually there needs to be some timber thinning done on those, but some of the things where you build structures and levees, that's not necessarily going to generate revenue to go back into the fund. But it's, what it's really doing is empowering state agencies to manage on federal land and private land to increase wildlife habitat.
And I was guessing we were going to get to the subject of burning, both because of your background and the fact that you live in Arkansas, where the Southeast is incredibly effective at burning timber ground compared to the West out here. So is that one of the issues that you can point to when you say like the ineffectiveness of federal management?
Yeah. And, you know, burning is so good for wildlife habitat, and it's been proven over and over again. Now, the forest is going to burn. Like, we're seeing a lot of Western forests that burn, but they're burning catastrophically, destroying everything on the landscape, taking out all the trees, all the underbrush. And sometimes these fires are so hot, they actually sterilize the soil where you can't get new forest to grow back. I'll give you an example here in Arkansas on the Ouachita Forest. And this was done by the Forest Service. It's just not being done at a large enough scale. But they implemented a program many years ago to create habitat for the red-cockaded woodpecker, which is an endangered species. And, you know, they went back and researched the records of when the earliest European explorers came through this area. And in their journals, they wrote you could ride through the forest at full gait on a horse. Well, the forests are so overgrown now, you'd have a hard time leading a horse through some of these forests. And they also know that this larger trees, widely spaced, where sun can get down to the forest floor and cause new growth to come up, that creates great wildlife habitat. So they implemented this program. And now they're trapping red-cockaded woodpeckers off of these sites to move them to other sites to do the same kind of work. And what they found was when they opened it up and did the controlled burns, that there was a seed bank in the soil that was probably over 100 years old that sprouted up. They had all kinds of new early successional habitat that came up. Species that all kinds of animals like. So they saw an increase in plant biodiversity. They saw the number of red-cockaded woodpeckers increase. They saw an increase in songbirds, more wild turkey, more deer, more rabbits, and more quail, which we're losing our quail population in Arkansas as well as other parts of the country.
So you had a couple of points in there that I think would be great, because obviously we want to talk about the classic question of how do we pay for it? But then we also want to hit Recovering America's Wildlife Act as well. And I think that mention of the red-cockaded woodpecker would be a good way to kind of talk about that legislation that is out there and what some of the differences are, or if you see your bill as something that could run in parallel, or, you know, how you see both of these bills working together or apart for that matter.
Yeah. America's Wildlife Habitat Conservation Act is a different approach than the bill that's been floating around in Congress called Recovering America's Wildlife Act, or RAWA. And you know, there's some problems I've got with RAWA. I like the idea behind RAWA to do what we're doing with America's Wildlife Habitat Conservation Act, and that is to get more state agencies involved in the management. But RAWA has a huge price tag to it. And, you know, when you say recover America's wildlife, I really don't know what that means. I can tell you how you recover wildlife is you fix the habitat. Until we fix the habitat, we're not going to be able to recover wildlife. We're not going to be able to have more protections for endangered species, it all comes back to habitat. And the focus on my bill is to really hone down to where the rubber meets the road, and that's getting out and doing the work on the habitat. Now, RAWA has it's mandatory permanent spending that's not offset, which it just can't move through this Congress. And I think it would have a hard time moving through any Congress as a mandatory funding program. And it's talking about $1.3 billion a year going to the states without the real focus on habitat management like my bill focuses on. And RAWA doesn't have any other source of funding other than just a stream of money coming from the federal government. So both of these bills are aimed at making sure we have the right habitat for wildlife going forward. I just think that the bill that we've got in committee right now is one that's going to achieve that better. It's going to work better with getting the state agencies out on the federal lands, and I think getting the state agencies working with the private landowners. So there's some good things about RAWA and some things I agree with in principle. I think it's just the approach in today's world of how it's funded and what the real emphasis is on it. You can't just throw money at a problem and fix it. You've got to have a program that will actually get work done on the ground, and that's what we're trying to achieve with the American Wildlife Habitat Conservation Act.
Well, thank you for that. The any time you see habitat in the title of a bill, I certainly get excited and think folks are thinking in the right direction.
But another thing about the American Wildlife Habitat Conservation Act is it would be a 5-year authorization. So it's kind of like the farm bill that we've got now that works pretty well, where Congress would have to come back in 5 years and we could look at what's working and what's not working. If things needed to be tweaked, you would do that every 5 years when you updated the program.
Yeah, especially when you talk habitat or forests, they're constantly changing. If you spend enough time out there, you always recognize that. So having some mobility to move and shake, I think could certainly be a benefit.
For all you elk hunters out there, chasing turkeys is basically the same thing. I know the reaction you just gave me, but don't knock it till you try it, and don't try it without OnX. The Hunt app will not only help you find new areas on public ground, but I use it to find out landowner info to get permission on private ground that I see birds on as well. OnX Hunt has a special offer for you. Use code CAL to receive 20% off your membership at onxmaps.com/hunt and find more birds this spring. We've all seen plenty of gadgets and fads come and go, but here's one product that stood the test of time. Seafoam motor treatment. Lots of hunters and anglers know that Seafoam helps engines run better and last longer. It's really simple. When you pour it in your gas tank, Seafoam cleans harmful fuel deposits that cause engine problems. I'm talking common stuff like hard starts, rough engine performance, or lost fuel economy. Seafoam is an easy way to prevent or overcome these problems. Just pour a can in your gas tank and let it clean your fuel system. You probably know someone who has used a can of Seafoam to get their truck or boat going again. I guarantee you've listened to them because I use it, you know, regularly. People everywhere rely on Seafoam to keep their trucks, boats, and small engines running the way they should the entire season. Help your engine run better and last longer. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit seafoamworks.com to learn more. Hey, I just sat down with the owners and operators of Maui Nui Venison. You've heard that name before because I've talked about them here on this podcast. They're on a mission to balance axis deer populations on Maui while giving back to the community and run a totally sustainable operation. Now, it's wild axis deer, which is an invasive species, but this operation is monitored and observed by the USDA, and they can commercially sell axis deer. Last time I went out to Maui to hunt axis, I did not kill one, which is where Maui Nui Venison would come in very handy for folks like me who want to get your own meat but aren't always successful and still want to have something in the freezer or handy in the form of a snack stick that is as close to getting your own as you can get, which is what Maui Nui Venison is.
You can become a snack subscriber, get some Axis Deer sticks sent right to your door. Visit MauiNuiVenison.com. That's M-A-U-I-N-U-I, venison.com. And use promo code CAL for 20% off your first order.
Now, you said the word authorization, and I think that is something we should point out. In the Recovering America's Wildlife Act, you see the word appropriation a lot on how to fund this goes. Would you mind just giving our listeners the difference between authorize and appropriate?
Yeah, and that's a distinction that we need to understand on all kinds of federal legislation. But the Natural Resource Committee is an authorizing committee, which means we authorize a program to exist. We also have an appropriations committee that appropriates funding for programs. So the bill that I've got, we would authorize it in the Resources Committee. We would tell what the offsets were for the appropriation, and then the Appropriations Committee would actually pass the funding for the bill. The RAWA bill would be appropriating with the authorization, and that's what you call mandatory spending. And those are the programs that have gotten out of control and that are running the debt up in our country. It's easy to do that in a sense, but you pay for it on the back end because you're not being responsible with taxpayer dollars, and you're just saying we're going to borrow more money to do this program. And, you know, it's a good program, but how are we really going to pay for it when we've got such a, you know, 30 some odd trillion dollar debt already? So, mandatory spending makes up almost three-fourths of all the spending in the federal government. At least 70% of all spending is mandatory spending. And the money that gets appropriated, which is the military and what's called non-defense discretionary spending, that gets appropriated every year. So the approach we're taking with this bill is one that we would authorize the program and authorize the spending levels, and then we would work with the Appropriations Committee to actually send the funding out to the states.
So if, I thought that was a great explanation, thank you. Now, if on the RAWA, Recovering America's Wildlife Act front, that appropriations is the big hurdle for that bill, what do you see as the big hurdle for your habitat bill?
Well, it will still be appropriations, but we're talking about $320 million a year. Plus, we know where we can offset that $320 million a year, where RAWA would be $1.3 billion a year from until Congress changed that. You wouldn't even have to go back and do any kind of appropriations after the bill were passed, because it would be a bill from Congress saying we're mandating that this program be funded, and it doesn't say where the money's coming from. It's just saying to the administration to fund this program. And with my bill, with an appropriation, you get to look at it every year and see if it's being effective or not. You can increase or decrease the appropriation accordingly. But with RAWA, it would be a one-time deal where the bill was passed, and until Congress came back and said, we're not going to fund this anymore, it would be permanently funded for as long as the United States government stays intact. So you got to do a lot more work and really stay on top of these programs when you're actually going through the appropriations process, and when you just say, okay, states, we're going to send you $1.3 billion a year into perpetuity, and it's not going to be offset, and it's going to be there every year. So, I think it's more fiscally responsible to have a program that gets reviewed every 5 years, and the appropriation has to go through the Appropriations Committee every year.
And where you're at right now, what do you think the pushback is going to be on the habitat bill?
I really don't think there should be a pushback, because we've identified offsets for the appropriation. I think if there's a pushback, I think it'll just be politics with us being an election year. But I'm still planning to have a hearing on the bill, pass the bill out of committee, and hopefully be able to move it through Congress, and we can start getting this work done on the ground to actually help the habitat, which is, as we already talked about, is the key in getting more wildlife. Is it's like the baseball movie. If you build it, they will come. If you create habitat, wildlife will come to that habitat.
That's right. Field of dreams. Very appropriate for upland bird hunters, whitetail hunters, everybody. I can see it right now. Where are you at on co-sponsors?
I think we've got about 20 co-sponsors right now in the House, and we just filed the bill last week. I think we'll probably pick up more co-sponsors as we move through the process. I've talked to a lot of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle about co-sponsoring it, and they've been reluctant to do that so far. I think it's because they're pushing for RAWA, and they see this as a threat to RAWA, which really, if they can get RAWA passed with the funding at some point down the road, the two could probably work in conjunction. But the goal is the same overall, and that's to increase the amount of wildlife in America. But to do that, it's going to have to be focused on habitat. And we're also another component of the American Wildlife Habitat Conservation Act is we would partner with tribes. There's a lot of tribal land, and tribes do a pretty good job of managing their land. I was out in New Mexico with the Mescalero Apache, and they've got some of the most beautiful ponderosa pine habitat out there I've seen anywhere. And they've also got monster elk that are on that reservation. And these tribes know how to manage the land. And oftentimes their land gets destroyed because the BLM or the Forest Service is not managing their land, and it catches on fire and gets over on the tribal land. So we want to give tribes that same authority to manage on the Forest Service and on the BLM as we're giving state agencies the authority to do.
And would the state or the tribal authority, would they be putting in for bids for that management? Or
yeah, I think that's how it would work. So you would actually see a growth in the private sector. You're going to need people on the ground doing the work. And if you've got the state agency coordinating that, they're going to have contacts with loggers, with other people who do controlled burns and those sort of things. And they'll have a pool of those resources, even consulting foresters and consulting wildlife biologists that they would probably employ to go out and do a lot of this work on the ground. So I think you would see a growth in the private sector as well because of the people that you would need to actually go out and do the work. And same thing with the tribes. And, you know, some tribes have their own crews that do the work, but we're talking about enough work here that it's going to take more people and more equipment to actually get it done.
When you talk about some of the, you know, the federal inability to manage, what does that stem from? This is obviously a in your experience type of question.
Yeah, a lot of it goes back to well-meaning laws that we put in place. Like there's one called NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, and it provides a tool for groups to come in and sue the federal government to stop management. And they've done this so much on forest management out west that it's almost impossible to do this work because it gets tied up in court. And there's even laws in Congress called the Equal Access to Justice Act that will actually pay the legal fees of groups that sue the federal government to stop these projects. So we get mired down and these laws get weaponized. Even the Endangered Species Act gets weaponized. And at the end of the day, it's bad for the endangered species because the habitat's not improving. And, I think some of this stuff, I know the laws were well-meaning when they were passed, but I think there are groups that have figured out how to make money off of saying they're doing something that they're really doing just the opposite. They say they're protecting the environment, say they're protecting the wildlands. And at the end of the day, what they're doing is more harm than good. So the state agencies would have be able to use existing what are called categorical exclusions on the federal lands that are already there in place to do the management for wildlife habitat. And they would be able to work with their federal partners to do that that actual work on the ground and hopefully insulate them from a lot of the lawsuits and everything that stops the federal agencies from getting work done.
You bring up a good point there, the preservation versus conservation conversation. Often it's an odd thing when people or groups request a level of preservation that actually doesn't really exist in nature, right? So like you said, you go back through that seed bank, you can see how often those seeds were generated, and especially if they're generated by fire, that preservation mindset can be just as damaging to wildlife as some of the things that I think some of these groups are trying to prevent. So
now you're spot on, Ryan. And I've got a saying. I say preservation is for pickles and conservation is for critters. And what I mean by that is nature is a live, dynamic, changing organism. Whether you're looking at the landscape scale or a stand of forest, it's not going to stay the same. And the only way you can preserve that, which means to keep it in its current state, if when you talk about nature, you pick a cucumber and boil it in vinegar and you preserve that cucumber as a pickle. But you can't do that and have the wildlife habitat like we want. Conservation is where you use what you've got and you leave it in better shape for the future generations. That's what forestry management is it's always focused on the future and leaving the forest in a better shape than when we found it. And when we have healthy forest, we get better air quality, we get better water quality, which is also wonderful for fisheries. We get better wildlife habitat, we get better places to recreate. It's a winning situation when we take care and we're good stewards of the land that we have. And this idea that we can go out and lock it up, put a fence around it, and just look at it, it doesn't work that way. The trees are going to continue to grow. They're going to start competing for sunlight. They're going to compete for moisture and nutrients. And they're going to get weak, and insects and disease will attack them, and it just makes a tinderbox for when the fire comes through. And we've seen that over and over and over on our forest, especially in the West. There's a much better way to do it that would be good for all those things that I mentioned. And as hunters and fishermen and conservationists and as environmentalists, we would have a much better situation if we would just take care of these federal lands and our private lands in a way that they should be taken care of. I don't think we realize how much more wildlife and game we could have in this country if we were managing the lands that we have appropriately.
If the folks listening would like to get involved, is there a way for us to do so now, or are we going to wait until this bill hits committee and maybe folks can write committee members in support of or comment on?
No, it's never too early to start advocating for good legislation. So wherever you are across the country, if you appreciate good wildlife habitat, I would encourage you to reach out to your members of Congress, to your senators, and encourage them to get behind this bill. And whether they're Democrat or Republican, we need everybody on board to get this passed. So, call your congressman, send them an email or reach out to them on social media. All of that stuff matters, and there's no better time to get started than right now.
Speaking as a representative that's probably received an email or a phone call or two, what's the most effective way to reach out to our elected officials?
Well, you can get on a browser and just you can type in where your state is and ask who your congressman is. And, it's easy to find who your representative is. We all have websites. We all have social media. And we all have phones that go to our office. And all of that information is readily available on the internet. So there's no excuse for not reaching out if there's something that you're passionate about, and it does make a difference.
Well, that's fantastic.
If you're my constituent, you can reach me at westerman.house.gov. That's our website. And we also have a Natural Resources Committee website, and I've got all the social media platforms out there as well.
Excellent. Well, you heard it here, folks. Thank you so much, Representative Westerman. The bill that we were talking about today is America's Wildlife Habitat Conservation Act. And you heard it here. If you want to get involved, write, email, stand up, wave your hand, and get in touch with your elected officials. Let them know that the great out of doors is important to you. That's where you like to spend your time and your money, and bring the family. So again, thank you very much. And we'll be keeping everybody posted on the progress.
Well, appreciate it, Ryan, and appreciate what you guys do. Very popular platform that you've got out there. And I'll hear strangers talking about meat eaters all the time. So y'all are doing the Lord's work, and appreciate your dedication to conservation and to the things that a lot of us really enjoy.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I got an old outfitter that I worked for whose wife is just a fanatical Razorback. So I'm already getting brownie points from her for having you on.
Go Hogs.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you so much for listening. Very important for you to know here that Recovering America's Wildlife Act, which has been in the works for a really long time, that we mentioned here during this segment many times, that is still active. It's still growing sponsors. And if you want the opinion piece side of this, it goes back to appropriation versus authorization. Now, for me, as the wildlife, habitat, access loving dude that I am, I would rather have appropriation. That means the dollars are put in the fund and they are meant to be spent on wildlife and habitat. As Representative Westerman points out, that may not be able to get done. It's not super palliative for a lot of fiscally conservative folks because it's money that is in a fund, ready to go. It has to be spent, and that can raise some red flags with some folks. Whereas the authorization mode of transport for Representative Westerman's bill is, it's got some good and bad things. You're going to be able to control where the money comes from, but you may have to fight for that money each and every year. Got it? Yeah, make up your own mind. That's why I'm here. Thank you so much for listening. Remember to write in to ASKCAL, that's AskCal@TheMeatEater.com, and let me know what's going on in your neck of the woods. If you're liking these interviews, let us know who you want to interview next. We'll get on it. Thanks again. We'll talk to you next week. Hey, I just sat down with the owners and operators of Maui Nui Venison. They're on a mission to balance axis deer populations on Maui while giving back to the community and run a totally sustainable operation.
For folks like me who want to get your own meat but aren't always successful,
you can become a snack subscriber, get some axis deer sticks sent right to your door. Visit MauiNuiVenison.com. That's MauiNui. Venison.com and use promo code CAL for 20% off your first order.
I'm sure a lot of you guys remember the old ceremonial hunting tradition of eating the heart out of the first animal you kill. Meat from those organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. You can get those same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And remember, use code MeatEater for 10% off your purchase.